listening to The Green Majority here out of CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. We're broadcasting here and on 18 other stations coast to coast, hopefully more. We have a goal to get that to 25 stations by June. That is our goal. So if anybody wants to help with that, if you're listening to us perhaps on a podcast and you haven't found us at your local radio station, if you've got a community station in the area, go ahead and give us a hand there. We'd really appreciate the help. Send them an email, give them a phone call. Just don't harass them or anything, but always looking for other stations to help get the word out about some of these important issues. So we'd really, really appreciate that. That's kind of something we're focusing on at the moment, is trying to get the word out about the show as much as possible. One of the things we're going to be doing today is actually playing a whole bunch of pre-recorded content. And the reason for that, if you've been listening, if you've been paying attention for the last few weeks, is that Ari, myself, and a very helpful volunteer, Giacomo, who isn't actually connected to the show directly, he just sort of volunteered his time as a cameraman, spent all day, including me rising at 5:30, which for anyone who knows me personally is about 5.5 hours before I would ever normally wake up. So that's quite an accomplishment as onto itself. To be at the Canadian International Auto Show for 7:30 a.m. for the media breakfast, some lovely continental bad coffee and stale croissants, to be followed by various interviews. So we spent about 6-7 hours yesterday at the auto show. We got tons of interviews, as we did last year. What we didn't have last year that we did do this year is that we actually had a videographer, as I just mentioned. So we've got a whole bunch of fun stuff. We at times got bored with talking to people. It's quite a long show, and you have to wait quite a while in between presentations to actually be able to speak to people. So as I was just actually talking to Kevin Farmer, who's in the studio with me as well this morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Yeah, good morning, Darren.
Was that we had a bit of fun goofing off as well in between stuff. I don't want to ruin any of the fun, but let's just say that other journalists noticed that we weren't with a major publication. I'll leave it at that as a teaser for now. It was all in good fun. I didn't actually get arrested. I'll leave that as a tease. And we're going to be putting that up. It's going to take a couple of weeks. We got quite a bit of footage we're going to do. It'll be our first Green Majority own produced YouTube video, to be followed by regular YouTube content, but it will be the sort of a launch of our actual own content on the YouTube channel. So if you haven't done it already, go ahead and subscribe to our YouTube channel. As I said, right now, it's just a list of subscriptions to other quality organizations like David Suzuki and that sort of thing. But we will shortly be putting our own content up on there. So to not miss that, go ahead and add us now, and then you'll start seeing videos from us popping up, starting with the auto show. But because of that, I was completely exhausted yesterday. We're going to cheat a little bit today. We've got a whole bunch of pre-recorded stuff we're going to talk about, but that doesn't mean it's boring. That doesn't mean it's not quality. We've got some really outstanding, a couple of outstanding TED Talks. I finally am going to play the story of Stuff Cosmetics. I bumped that right up to the front of the list so that we could make sure that we got to that today. I know Kevin's going to come in and talk about some news stories. One of the things, just because we really didn't have a lot to say with it, maybe I'll just get out of the way right now, was there's a massive Keystone XL pipeline in the U.S. was one of the headlines this week. I think the major news item on that, though, was that the Sierra Club U.S. Now, I don't know if that's Sierra Club across the board. I believe it is, but I would have to fact check that. But at least the American portion of Sierra Club, breaking 120 years of basically a ban on public action or civil disobedience, I believe was the specific language there. They've decided to break that 120-year abstinence from civil disobedience because of the Keystone Project. So, Kevin, did you have any comments on that? Do you think that that's, is that like a big deal? Should we be really like, wow?
Well, it made it into the news, so which it was attention grabbing, which is really what the whole point of the action was. And it's just very exciting for me to see that opposition to this pipeline is not going away, and in fact, if anything, it's stiffening. Like I'm just dying to see what happens now with regards to Obama's position on the pipeline, because he initially rejected it based on opposition from was it Delaware? They didn't like the route it was going across aquifers and sensitive lands in one state. I don't want to say Delaware. I think it's Delaware, but it could have been Nebraska. Sorry, my geography is just not my strong point. But there was one state that was objecting because of aquifers and sensitive lands, and so that was the initial reason that the pipeline got rejected. But they have since approved the new route for the pipeline, and that's kind of up the ante now. And we get, you know, and so goes the opposition, and so goes the political debate. And I'm just honestly dying to see how this one turns out.
Well, I think one of the interesting things there's kind of two points I want to make on that. One of them is the fact that one of some of the critics to opposing it, somebody on from the Canadian Environment a while ago about his article talking about how he thought that individual pipelines and stuff like that was the wrong fight. To which I have to admit I'm somewhat sympathetic that maybe those things, I think they're very important, and I'm certainly not completely like we shouldn't be opposing things like Keystone, but I think there is an argument to be made too that there are other areas where maybe are more effective to be spending energy. But one of the side points on that maybe completely refutes that entire point was people will say, well, okay, well, if you oppose the plan, what you're really doing is you're not opposing the pipeline, you're opposing that pipeline route. But maybe if we keep opposing all the routes until there actually is one route that's either actually is environmentally like negligible as far as damage, or we just drive the cost up so much because we have them zigzagging across the entire country all the way down that maybe we could like get them to say, you know what, throw up their hands and be like, this isn't worth the trouble. I don't think that's very likely, but an amusing side point. The other side point, the thing that I think is worth mentioning, and I don't even really know how I feel about it, but I think it's something important to point out, was that I saw this perhaps as a bigger move than you did on Sierra Club's point. I'm skeptical as far as the impact of them joining it, but what it does show how serious they are about it, because mm-hmm. and I don't think that's like bravado or just sort of, you know, attention grabbing, because that's a card they can't play again for another 100 years. Right? So yeah. I mean, at least from their point of view, that's a fairly significant like sand in the flag, or right. or line in the sand, if you will, right. if I'm mixing my metaphors again. I think it says a lot about their conviction to stopping this project. Now, whether or not that will translate into the other side taking them seriously or to rally support, I mean, that remains to be seen and I think could be argued. But from their point of view, I think that's a pretty significant move. I think that's definitely newsworthy.
It was because it made the news.
Yeah. It's a tautology, almost by definition.
Yeah. it accomplished its goal, which was to highlight opposition and to ratchet up the pressure on the Obama administration to further reject the pipeline, mm-hmm. even with the new route.
Now, I think Sierra Club in general is pretty good about their sort of strategic planning. So, I mean, the other thing there is not just that they did that, but that they suppose this moment, right? I mean, we've been talking about Keystone for years now already, and we'll likely be talking about it for at least another, you know, year or two. Even if it gets killed somehow, we'll be talking about it for a while. But they chose this moment to play that card, and I'm sort of wondering if maybe that indicates that they think that sort of there's enough momentum with just that little extra push that there something can be accomplished. I'd really like to get somebody from American Sierra Club on to talk about that. Maybe we'll try and get that organized for next week. I just didn't have enough sleep this week to get anything.
Yeah,
like that.
I think you're right, and I think honestly it's been Obama who's been his rhetoric that's been galvanizing action, because he has really opened the door wide to opposition to you know, dirty oil and the pipeline in particular, and I think he has really roused the environmentalists in the states, because he has been using such positive and encouraging rhetoric from their standpoint.
Okay, well, I think without getting someone from Sierra Club on the air, I think that's all we can say about it for now. But it's definitely something we'll keeping an eye on, and I'll make a note to try and get a hold of somebody from Sierra Club US for next week. For now, however, without further ado, we're going to start with our first pre-record. This one is a TED Talks, and I do apologize in advance for potentially butchering this gentleman's names, but I believe it's Fahad Al-Attiyah, and it's a TED Talks. He's talking about his home country of Qatar. He is talking a little bit about basically the TED Talk sort of starts out like a PR commercial for Qatar. He's the chairman of Qatar's National Food Security Program, and it starts out being very, very complimentary, and then he slowly sort of peels back the veneer of some of the more questionable issues that they have to deal with, and shows some of the fragility, even among some of the richest nations on the planet. Qatar, of course, is a very, very rich oil nation, very influential in the Middle East, and I think you'll really enjoy this talk. We'll come back and maybe have a comment about it afterwards, but without further ado, we're going to go ahead. This is called A Country with No Water by Fahad Al-Attiyah.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Doha. I am in charge of making this country food secure. That is my job for the next 2 years, to design an entire master plan, and then for the next 10 years to implement it. Of course, with so many other people, but first I need to talk to you about a story, which is my story, and about the story of this country that you all here in today. And of course, most of you have had 3 meals today, and probably will continue to have after this event. So, going in, what was Qatar in the 1940s? We were about 11,000 people living here. And there was no water, there was no energy, no oil, no cars, none of that. Most of the people lived here, either lived in coastal villages, fishing, or nomads, roamed around with the environment, trying to find water. None of the glamour that you see today existed. No cities like you see today in Doha or Dubai or Abu Dhabi or Kuwait or Riyadh. It wasn't that they couldn't develop cities. Resources weren't there to develop them. And you can see that life expectancy was also short. Most people died at around the age of 50. So let's move to chapter 2, the oil era. 1939, that's when they discovered oil. But unfortunately, it wasn't really fully exploited commercially until after the Second World War. What did it do? It changed the face of this country, as you can see today and witness. It also made all those people who roamed around the desert, looking for water, looking for food, trying to take care of their livestock, urbanize. You might find this strange, but in my family, we have different accents. My mother has an accent that is so different to my father, and we are all a population of about 300,000 people in the same country. There are about 5 or 6 accents in this country as I speak. And someone says, how so? How could this happen? Because we lived scattered. We couldn't live in a concentrated way simply because there was no resources. And when the resources came, be it oil, we started building these fancy technologies and bringing people together because we needed the concentration. People started to get to know each other. And we realized that, well, there are some differences in accents. So that is the chapter 2 of the oil era. Let's look at today. And this is probably the skyline that most of you know about Doha. So what's the population today? It's 1.7 million people. That is in less than 60 years. The average growth of our economy is about 15% for the past 5 years. Lifespan has increased to 78. Water consumption has increased to 430 liters, and this is amongst the highest worldwide. From having no water whatsoever to consuming water to the highest degree, higher than any other nation. I don't know if this was a reaction of the lack of water, but what is interesting about the story that I've just said? The interesting part is that we continue to grow 15% every year for the past 5 years without water. Now that is historic. Never happened before in history. Cities were totally wiped out because of the lack of water. This is history being made in this region. Not only cities that we're building, but cities with dreams, and people who are wishing to be scientists, doctors, live, build a nice home, bring the architect, design my house. These people are adamant that this is a livable space when it wasn't. But of course, with the use of technology. So Brazil has 1,782 millimeters per year of precipitation of rain. Qatar has 74, and we have that growth rate. Question is how? How could we survive that? We have no water whatsoever, simply because of this gigantic mammoth machine called desalination. Energy is the key factor here. It changed everything. It is that thing that we pump out of the ground, we burn tons of, probably most of you used it coming to Doha. So that is our lake, if you can see it. That is our river. That is how you all happen to use and enjoy water. This is the best technology that this region could ever have. Desalination. So what is the risks? Do you worry much? And I would say, perhaps if you look at the global facts, you will realize that you of course have to worry. There's growing demand, growing population. We've turned 7 billion only a few months ago. And so that number also demands food. And there's predictions that we'll be 9 billion by 2050. So a country that has no water has to worry about what happens beyond its borders. There's also changing diets. By elevating to a higher socioeconomic level, they also change diet. They start eating more meat, so on and so forth. On the other hand, there's declining yields because of climate change and because of other factors. And so someone has to really realize when the crisis is going to happen. This is the situation in Qatar, for those who don't know. We only have 2 days of water reserve. We import 90% of our food, and we only cultivate less than 1% of our land. The limited number of farmers that we have been pushed out of their farming practices as a result of open market policy and bringing the bigger competitions, etc., etc. So we also face risks. And these risks directly affect the sustainability of this nation and its continuity. The question is there a solution? Is there a sustainable solution? Indeed, there is. This slide sums up thousands of pages of technical documents that we've been working on over the past 2 years. Let's start with the water. So we know very well, I've showed you earlier, that we need this energy. So if we're going to need energy, what sort of energy? A depletable energy, fossil fuel, or should we use something else? Do we have the comparative advantage to use the other sort of energy? And I guess most of you by now realize that we do, 300 days of sun. And so we will use that energy, renewable energy, to produce the water that we need. And we will probably put 1,800 megawatt of solar systems to produce 3.5 million cubic meters of water. And that is a lot of water. And that water will go then to the farmers, and the farmers will be able to water their plants, and they will be able then to supply society with food. But in order to sustain the horizontal line, because these are the projects, these are the systems that we will deliver, we need to also develop the vertical line, system sustenance, high-level education, research and development, industries, technologies to produce these technologies for application, and finally markets. But what gels all of it, what enables it, is legislation, policies, regulations. Without it, we can't do anything. So that's what we're planning to do. Within 2 years, we should hopefully be done with this plan and taking it to implementation. Our objective is to be a millennium city, just like many millennium cities around. Istanbul, Rome, London, Paris, Damascus, Cairo. We're only 60 years old, but we want to live forever as a city, to live in peace. So thank you very much.
All right. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. That was Fahad bin Mohammed Al-Attiya. It was my best attempt to say his name properly. That was at TED Talks called A Country with No Water, talking about his home, Qatar, being an oil-rich country, but desperately needing water. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we will be back. Kevin and I are going to toss around some news stories. We've got some more great content for you, so don't go anywhere. Enjoy this music brought to you by Amber Waves. We'll be right back.
In my head is leaving me again. Oh, 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 oh. might be unlikely to ever just be sure.
All right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I've got Kevin Farmer in studio here. But just before we go, I want to, or just before we move on to the next piece, I want to thank, of course, DJ Amber Waves for providing all of our fantastic music each and every week for the show. It is all Canadian content. She does a very, very well-researched, and I really actually don't know how she gets sleep. She might actually be one of the people that few people I know that got actually less sleep than I do. Because it's just absolutely incredible how much she puts up on there. If you're interested in music at all, especially if you're interested in Canadian music, you want to go and check out Open Till Midnight Blogs. And there's going to be a link on the website as well after, as there always is, but there's a really, really good reason to, if you're listening and you're like, oh, I keep meaning to go and check out that blog, but today's the day. In fact, don't go outside of the range of your radio, but you may want to, in fact, go and do it right now because she participates very heavily in Canadian Music Week, and there is actually some special prize giveaway she's going to be doing just for simple things like signing up for her Twitter. So you go ahead while you're listening here without getting too far away from your radio, walk over to your computer, and if you happen to be listening on an actual radio, if you're already listening on your computer, well then you don't need to go anywhere. But make sure you sign up for her stuff. Check out Open Till Midnight Blogs. It's otmblog.com, I believe. But again, you can double check our website for that. Each and every post has a link to her Facebook and website and everything like that. Really good time to go and check it out because you could go and win some free stuff just for doing stuff like following her on Twitter. No purchase necessary and all that. Without further ado, though, I want to move on to a new story. Kevin, we were talking about sea urchins. Do you want to describe the story for us a bit?
Yeah, so a scientist researcher has discovered the process by which sea urchins convert carbon dioxide into calcium carbonate to form their exoskeleton. And what he's discovered is that they take advantage of a catalyzing agent in the form of nickel ions, which are freely available in the water. And excuse me. And this is I found this to be particularly exciting news because it's potentially the very first time I've heard of a useful technology for carbon sequestration. Mm-hmm. Right now, what we have is really, really flimsy notions of capturing carbon, in itself an interesting prospect, and burying it, just simply pumping it into underground structures or pumping it deep enough into the ocean that temperature and pressure will just sort of keep it imprisoned at the bottom of the ocean in huge, you know, balls of carbon dioxide. And I've always lived in fear of these carbon sequestration projects because they just seem to be, first of all, it's a business as usual strategy, which just says, let's keep pumping out carbon.
And has nobody seen Godzilla? Clearly the bottom of the ocean is not a permanent storage container for anything.
Yeah. That's the thing is that this is a large, these would be very large scale experiments, none of which we know for certain how they will behave. And meanwhile, we're pumping out more and more carbon dioxide and potentially creating a huge carbon dioxide bomb that will go off in future generations as these structures turn out to be permeable or turn out not to be stable or so then suddenly we've doubled down on carbon dioxide and we've got our existing sources plus all the stuff we've been supposedly sequestering. The chemistry that this researcher has discovered would convert carbon dioxide into chalk, essentially, which has uses. Mm-hmm. we use chalk, and it's also stable. As far as I know, chalk is stable. It doesn't revert back into its gaseous form. And if that's true, what we'd have is a way to sequester carbon that doesn't scare the pants off me, you know, that shows some form of permanence, some form of stability. A point I was toying with making last week when we had our guest from 350.org on was that, you know, I totally approve of that organization, but they got the name wrong. It should be 280.org. What our guest pointed out was that the parts per million of carbon dioxide pre-industrial age was 280 parts per million. And what it is, and what they're aiming for is to stabilize it at 350 parts per million. And that's where the name of the organization comes from. And they do great work and I love them and I don't want to knock them, but they got the name wrong because 350 is this number that's kind of been co-opted in a sense out of its initial context.
Well, and to be fair, 350 sounds much more appealing than 280. It just has a better ring to it.
It's politically less terrifying to think of, you know, reducing. But the point is that according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, 350 parts per million is the point at which we stand a 50-50 chance of avoiding runaway climate change, which is the same as a 50-50 chance of achieving dangerous climate change.
I call heads.
Yeah, exactly. And to me, 50-50 is just too high. Like, that's loading three chambers in the gun and playing Russian roulette. So from my point of view, we've always needed to go to a zero carbon economy. But even after we've reduced our emissions to zero, we still need a program to sequester the inventory of carbon that we've already placed into the atmosphere. And this is the first thing I've ever read of that seems to have potential for accomplishing just that.
Mm-hmm. So we should mention this is a physicist, Dr. Linja Siller, a PhD student at Newcastle University. There will be a link to the article online afterwards. One of the things that jumped me here, though, is that she was talking about was talking about the sea urchin converting CO2 to calcium carbonate, as you mentioned. One of the issues that we were just talking about on the break there, of course, was that what immediately jumped to my mind was calcium carbonate and ocean acidification. These two things are in conflict. These are the calcium shells that a lot of sea creatures build up and develop. This is exactly what's eroded by ocean acidification,
right,
which is another consequence of climate change and other factors as well. So the thing to point out there is that this study is not saying we need more sea urchins,
right,
for a variety of reasons, one amongst which is that wouldn't be a solution because they would store the shells and then the ocean acidification would destroy the shells and then it would kill all the sea urchins. So what they're not proposing is simply to have sort of one of those bring in frogs to take care of the locusts type situations and sort of encourage sea urchin growth everywhere. What we're talking about is biomimicry. They're talking about taking this concept, this technology, if you will, this natural technology, and trying to apply it into on land or sort of human designed systems is basically what they're getting at there.
Yeah, it would be applicable to large installations like coal-fired plants and things like that. It wouldn't be applicable to things like cars, but if you were running your cars off electricity generated by clean or cleanable plants, scrubbable plants, then you might see significant advantage.
Okay, so without further ado then, we're going to carry on with the story of stuff. Thank you very much, Kevin. All the stories that we talk about, as well as I like to mention and remind everybody, is going to be listed on the post on our website, which is greenmajority.ca. I've been told sometimes I talk too fast, so I'm going to try to say things like our Facebook and Twitter addresses slightly extra slowly. So that's greenmajority.ca. Go ahead and check that out while we are getting started with our next feature, which of course is the story of stuff. The story of stuff project, if you hadn't heard or you're just tuning in for the first time today, is directed by Annie Leonard. They have a website where they go through and do these excellent animated videos hosted by Annie Leonard, outlining sort of the process about how things get from the starting materials to you in a way that's very easily digestible. It's I don't know if it was specifically designed with sort of younger audiences in mind, but you could easily take this to like a grade 5 class and play it for them, and that would have no problem. Really excellent, amazing teaching tool. I highly encourage you to go and check it out. This is one of many videos that they've put out, and again, all of these are audio taken from video. There's an excellent animation that goes along with it. So even if you're listening to the story of stuff, the story of cosmetics today, you should still go to the YouTube page and watch the actual video that it's from. Really, really great stuff. But without further ado today, we're going to get off on our road here with Annie Leonard and the story of cosmetics.
This is a story about a world obsessed with stuff. It's a story about a system in crisis. We're trashing the planet, we're trashing each other, and we're not even having fun. The good thing is that when we start to understand the system, we start to see lots of places to step in and turn these problems into solutions. Can I tell you, I love my Pantene Pro-V. Of the dozen or so personal care products that I use every day, it's the one I can't live without. Says it gives my dull hair the ultimate cool shine. How does it do that? I was wondering that while I was lathering it in my hair one day, so I read the ingredients right here. Sodium lauryl sulfate, tetrasodium EDTA, methyl isothiazolinone. What is this stuff? I took this list to some scientists who know how to read it. Turns out my Pantene contains a chemical linked to cancer. And lots of other products in my bathroom, from sunscreen to lipstick and even baby shampoo, also contain chemicals linked to cancer or other problems like learning disabilities, asthma, and even damaged sperm. Like most parents, I try to keep my family safe. But now I find out my bathroom is a minefield of toxins? What are we supposed to do? To find out the answers, we have to go back to one of the key features of our materials economy: toxics in, toxics out. If, at the factory, you pour toxic chemicals into a product, like baby shampoo, you're going to wind up with toxic baby shampoo and toxics in workers, communities, and, babies. So let's take a closer look at this toxic outrage where it seeps into our lives every day, in the bathroom. The average woman in the U.S. uses about 12 personal care products daily. The average man, about 6. Each product containing a dozen or more chemicals. Less than 20% of chemicals in cosmetics have been assessed for safety by the industry's safety panel, so we just don't know what they do to us when we use them. Would you fly on an airline that only inspects 20% of its planes? Of course, not all of these chemicals are dangerous, but we know that many are. Some are carcinogens. That means that they can cause cancer. Others are neurotoxins and reproductive toxins, proven to mess up brain development and reproduction in animals. Wait a minute, we're animals too. It's like a giant experiment. We're using all these mystery chemicals and just waiting to see what happens. One thing we do know is that they're getting inside us. I had my body's toxicity levels tested, and I'm loaded with things like mercury, flame retardants, triclosan, and lead. We all are. Even babies are being born pre-polluted. Now, I know we can't live in a lead-free world, but do we have to put lead in our lipstick? I don't know. Maybe it's my fault. Maybe I just bought the wrong thing. At the store, the choices seem endless. I can get lipstick in 49 shades, or shampoo for hair that's too dry, oily, fine, limp, or frizzy. But what about the choices that really matter? Like the choice to buy products that are safe? It turns out the important decisions don't happen when I choose to take a product off the shelf. They happen when companies and governments decide what products should go on the shelves. So who are these companies? This is Procter & Gamble. They're the ones offering me Herbal Essences, the number 2 shampoo in the country. It contains toxic petrochemicals made from oil. Since when is oil an herb? On cosmetics labels, words like herbal, natural, even organic have no legal definition. That means that anybody can put anything in a bottle and call it natural, and they do. I mean, can you imagine a top seller called Petro Essences? Gross. What's even nastier are hair relaxers marketed to 5-year-olds and skin whitening creams. These are super toxic, both in their ingredients and in the message they send about what beauty is. Ooh, here's Estee Lauder offering me a chance to help find a cure for breast cancer. That's nice. But wait, they're also using chemicals linked to cancer. Don't you think the best way for Estee Lauder to fight cancer is to stop using those chemicals in the first place? So really, I get to choose between meaningless claims on a bottle. But these guys get the real choice about what goes into those bottles. And that happens back here, at the factories where they're formulated. Why do the makers of these products use all these toxics? Are they trying to poison us? No, they're just working from a 1950s mindset when people were totally swept up in better living through chemistry. In all that excitement, they forgot to worry about human health impacts. That was years ago, and they are still using these same old toxic chemicals. Today, big cosmetics companies say the doses of poison in their products are small enough to be harmless. Yeah, maybe if you use them once a year. I guess they never get out and see that their products are being used and combined with other products every day. A little toxic dose under your arms, a little more on your hair, on your lips. And workers in nail and hair salons get dosed all day long. So the industry is used to doing things this way, and they can, because even now that scientists have linked the chemicals they're using to all sorts of problems, there are no laws to get rid of them. You're thinking, really? Come on, nobody's making sure that the stuff we smear all over our bodies is safe? Nope. The FDA doesn't even assess the safety of personal care products or their ingredients. Since 1938, they've banned just 8 out of over 12,000 ingredients used in cosmetics. They don't even require that all of the ingredients be listed on the label. Now, this is an example where we can all agree a little more government action would be helpful. This lack of regulation leaves a huge hole that the cosmetics industry is all too happy to fill. They set up their own committee to self-police their products, and compliance with their recommendations is voluntary. So the cosmetics industry is making the rules and then deciding whether or not to follow them. So you see, it isn't our fault that these toxic products are in our bathrooms. It's a whole broken system that's ignoring the simple rule, toxics in, toxics out. But we're not helpless. There are resources online that we can use to protect ourselves by identifying the best possible choices in the store. But the real action is with people working to change the system. Because if we really want to solve this problem, we got to start here with these guys. Women, parents, workers, people all over the country are demanding that Congress pass a new law, giving FDA the power to make sure that our personal care products are safe. We need common sense laws based on the precautionary principle. That means that when you're dealing with hazardous chemicals, just err on the side of caution. Let's not debate how much lead should be allowed in lipstick. Just get the toxic chemicals out of our products. Smarter laws would force companies to get past that old 50s mindset and figure out how to get us all clean and shiny without toxic chemicals. Can they? Totally. Many responsible cosmetics companies are already putting safer products on the market. Green chemists are developing substances that are designed to be safe and non-toxic in the first place. European governments have required the removal of many toxic chemicals, and companies have figured out how to comply. When cosmetics are reformulated to be safe and labeled honestly, then we can feel comfortable with the choices available at the store. We can choose bouncy hair or full hair, shiny lipstick or matte. We can even choose to feel beautiful without using 20 products. But we'll know that whatever we choose, the most important choice, the choice to be safe and healthy, has already been made.
All right, of course, you're listening to The Green Majority. That was Annie Leonard with the story of stuff, the video and all the content, all the news stories, absolutely everything that I mention, hopefully, as long as I remember to, gets linked on the show. So if there's anything you missed that I've said too fast, the only thing you need to catch is greenmajority.ca. That's all you need to remember because everything is on there. Links to our Facebooks, links to our Twitter, links to all the news stories we mentioned, links to all sorts of videos, links to everything. Potentially my personal phone number is on there. I have no idea. Anything could be on there. Whatever I decide to mention could be on the email list afterwards. However, we're going to take a quick music break and then we're going to come back. Kevin and I are going to toss around a couple more news stories and then we may still get to one pre-recorded feature later in the show. We're sort of taking today by ear, as I said. I sort of took the week off here a little bit because we're at the auto show, so stay tuned for that. If you missed the top of the show, we're at the Canadian International Auto Show all day yesterday. Tired me out a little bit, so we're sort of cheating with some pre-records today, but it's for a good cause. We're going to have some really, really good show coming up in a, I don't want to promise anything, but probably 2 weeks, maybe three, and then that will also launch our first venture into producing our own YouTube content. As we were walking around the auto show doing interviews with a camera, we had some good fun goofing off a little bit. Some delightful conversations with OPP officers, all sorts of fun things. But without further ado, we're going to take that music break and we will be right back. You're listening to The Green Majority. Stay tuned.
Disaster! now I know you're leaving, and I won't waste my heart on you, baby.
All right, we're back. You're listening to The Green Majority here, produced at CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. And as also, you could be listening to us on iTunes. You could be listening to us directly off our website. I could be listening to myself while editing the show right now, for all I know. You could be listening a variety of ways. You could be listening, as I said, on one of our 18 amazing, wonderful, and beloved community radio partners across the country. You could potentially be listening right now and contacting a local community station that does not currently carry us and telling them that they should do so. However, without further ado, Kevin is going to help us jump into a little bit more news here. There's been some talk in the Toronto Star today about Samsung's $7 billion deal. The way they put it was said that the deal is ripening. I don't know if that's the way that I would put it, but there has been some criticism about that, which is somewhat funny as a way to put it that way, because there's been criticism of this plan pretty much since the outset. Kevin, do you want to comment on either the deal itself or the story that sort of there's growing opposition to things like the Liberals' green energy plan in general, and specifically the Samsung deal?
Well, specifically the Samsung deal was always a bit sweet for me. It was a sweet deal for Samsung, and I thought it was unnecessarily sweet. it was kind of a little bit of political grandstanding, because it attracted on paper $700 billion worth of investment at a time when Ontario was in recession, and that was quite a quite a feather in the cap of Dalton McGuinty to brag that, you know, during these lean times his government was attracting such massive investment. We've only seen, you know, about 40% of that investment so far, and maybe about 40% of the promised jobs. It's taken years. Like the regulatory process has turned out to be extremely complicated for producing the deliverables in the contract. And then there was the notion, then there's the benefit to Samsung, which is the 20-year contracts with the feed-in tariffs, which were really high. So this investment is coming, on the one hand, is good. Like, you know, it's great. So we're getting all this investment in the Ontario economy, and it's green, you know, hopefully sustainable, money and infrastructure. But you pay downstream in the form of these really high prices for electricity, which are going to be guaranteed to Samsung for the 20 years of the contract. And it's like, well, the feed-in tariffs always struck me as too high. I thought they could have gotten the same for a lot less. And what it does is it energy in Ontario, at least, I mean, probably in every province, but it is always a contentious issue politically, And when energy prices go up, the electorate gets volatile. And what we've got now is people like Tim Hudak, trying to make political points by arguing against green energy because it's too expensive, and there might be some traction for that argument.
I should, just before we move on, I should point out as well that he's been, I mean, not that we're surprised, but he's been talking out of, he is a politician after all, but he's been talking out of both sides of his mouth on that issue, because he's also been making some sort of olive branches to the green energy community just in sort of different areas as well. He's been talking a little bit about his own sort of green plans and wanting to raise investment in different areas. So he's definitely, to be fair, because of course Green Majority, we don't support or oppose any particular political party, just good or bad environmental ideas. It should be pointed out, of course, that he's making comments in both directions, and I think his actual intentions outside of simply trying to make as many people like him as possible is very questionable on either case.
Yeah, his goal ultimately is, I think, just to break this particular deal. And for sure he's floated other ideas, like you say, but what we've got here is the case where this deal is vulnerable to you know, politicization. Mm-hmm. And basically because it will raise the cost of energy in Ontario. And despite the fact that I think the cost of energy should go up, we should be paying full freight for energy. The feed-in tariffs were just simply too generous in this case, and Samsung, you know, you can't blame Samsung for you know, gobbling
up a sweet deal.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you're going to put that in front of me, I'm going to take it.
Well, they'd all, if their shareholders got hold of them having turned it down, they would have been skinned alive and thrown out in the street. So yeah, I mean, I don't think we can put any blame on Samsung for
No, not at all. And I think in good faith they're trying to deliver on their end of the deal, but the regulatory process, like, they've had to deal with the opposition to the wind lobby opposition and deal with First Nations negotiations and sort of the patchwork quilt that is the regulatory process for energy development in Ontario.
I want to be sort of be clear that as much as I'm a policy nerd, I'm not an expert on this as much as I should be on this topic. But my sort of educated but not expert opinion on that is that it was probably the right deal, but they didn't do enough groundwork yet. As you said, the regulations weren't cleaned up and smoothed out and sort of streamlined enough first, made effective enough the roadblocks weren't moved ahead of times. Not, of course, that we should ignore First Nations issues, but those issues should have been resolved ahead of time, perhaps before this deal was the right deal. So it could have been right deal, wrong time, as much as it could have been wrong deal, right time.
Mm-hmm.
That was just sort of my point, was that it wasn't necessarily a bad deal, but the work wasn't done for it to be the right time for that deal.
Right. I see your point. I still think the feed-in tariffs are too high regardless. Like, I think, mm-hmm, in that sense it is a bad deal, in that they could have gotten – we could have gotten in the same level of investment for much, much less of a guaranteed return.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regards, I think it was a bad deal, and it makes it vulnerable to attack.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as I was looking at the time here, I was about to introduce another feature here, but we've actually eaten up most of our time here today. So I think what we'll do is we'll take just a really brief one more music break here, and then we'll come back and just sort of wrap up the show with a few minutes. So Kevin Farmer, thanks. If you wanted to stick around another couple of minutes, I'm sure you won't mind. You're listening to The Green Majority. We're going to, as I just said, we're going to take one more quick commercial break, and we'll come back and wrap up the show, and we'll talk to you soon. We are back. That was our last commercial break. That was our last music break provided to you by Open Till Midnight Blogs. DJ Amber Waves there again. I'm mentioning it more often than usual today because there is some really exciting Canadian Music Week stuff that she's doing, including reviews of a lot of the information, all the music that we've been given as all Canadian Music Week candidates or performers, and she is doing some prizes. So please, now is the time to go ahead and check out Open Till Midnight Blog. You'll find the link on the show page afterwards, which is, of course, greenmajority.ca. All this information is listed up there, along with links to all the features. Today, I'm going to put up up the actual each of the videos that that we talked about as features today that were based off either the TED Talk or the story of stuff. Those will both be embedded in the post. We're going to have links to all the news stories, everything you possibly might miss, or if you want some of the details or more context for any of the stuff that we were talking about, please do check out greenmajority.ca for all of that great information. However, with our last couple of minutes here, Kevin, we're going to talk a little bit about drugs. I was going to leave it to you with that one.
Yeah.
We had a story that's about the drugs that you take getting into water supplies.
Yeah, I forget where this particular study originated. Maybe you can remind me. But it's not the first. The reason I didn't remember where it took place is because it's far and away not the first time this study has taken place. In this particular article, what they were studying, I think it was a Swiss study actually. They were testing the effects of diluted levels of antidepressants on aquatic ecosystems. And what they were doing was they were assessing the behavior of fish at very low concentrations of a common antidepressant. And the control. So what's kind of funny in an awfully morbid kind of way is that the fish that were on the drugs became quite mellow, and when researchers entered the room, the control group fish would be afraid and swim away, whereas the ones getting the low doses of the drugs just kind of were very complacent and like didn't care, which in the environment is a suicide switch. If you don't care about getting caught and eaten, you are going to get caught and eaten. And it also altered their appetites, it altered their behaviors. But you know, a few years ago, there was a study in New York that gained a lot of notoriety because it tested the New York water supply for basically everything, and it just found everything it went looking for. Every single thing, every hormone they tested for, every pharmaceutical they tested for, every illegal drug they tested for.
I believe they checked for narcotics.
Yeah, they checked for narcotics. They found cocaine in their water.
Move to New York, just get high on the water. There you go.
Yeah, it was the water was literally like it just read like runoff from human society. It wasn't to think, and this is one of my favorite examples for just showing. Reminding people that we literally can't wrap our heads around the size of the impacts of human activity on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. We've reached the point where you can't even eat ocean-caught fish on a regular basis because we've put so much mercury and PCBs and dioxins and other chemicals in the...
I just wanted to confirm for you that it was actually a Swedish research team. You're right about that one. And one of the other things that I wanted to point out about that, too, about the fact that there are various trace levels, but trace can be deceiving because they're relatively small, but that doesn't mean they don't have an effect.
And it doesn't mean they don't interact with other drugs when
absolutely, and that was the thing I was going to say. How many people? Everyone's taken some sort of medication at some point in their life.
Yeah.
If you're over the age of 15, I would put money on the fact that you've taken something. Is that almost every single one of those bottles you've ever seen says, be careful not to mix this with XYZ.
Yeah.
Well, XYZ and PS and Q are all in the drinking water.
Exactly.
We have a serious problem here, folks.
And some chemicals have the effect of exacerbating other chemicals so that even though they're harmless or maybe the effects are negligible at so many parts per million, in the presence of another agent, they become quite chemically active. That's been proven with certain pesticides, which even at very, very low levels, when they come in contact with other drugs, become toxic at extremely low levels. And it's like you say, it's already all there in the drinking water, and we have no plans to deal with this. Apparently, according to this article, some water processing plants are being built that can filter out pharmaceuticals, but we are way behind the curve on this.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I hear, I actually have the article in front of me, and it's one of the quotes from one of the researchers who was saying, when I opened the door, the control fish got really scared and the other ones didn't even react.
Yeah.
As if they didn't notice that he was even there. So yeah. we're not talking about like they dissected them and put little tissue samples and use electron microscopes to find minute, changes in body chemistry. We're talking about like the fish that had one, the control group ran away as they should, and the other one's like, anybody could go, like a 3-year-old could walk up and say, there's something wrong with those fish, and those fish are normal.
Right, right.
You know, so I think there's really, really drastic there. However, we are out of time. That's all the time we've got for today. So, Kevin, thanks once again for coming into studio and joining us today.
Thanks, Darren.
And we'll have some more exciting stuff next week. Hopefully, I promise you next week we will have some fresh interviews for you. Of course, we love playing TED Talks, but I try to get as much original content as we possibly can. So we'll be back to our regular scheduled show next week. The week after that, I'm hoping, although I'm not willing to promise yet, we will have our auto show, either that one or the week after. And all our YouTube comment, everything else you could possibly want to know, the show as well, of course, is on greenmajority.ca. I want to thank once again all of our wonderful syndicates across the country. And I guess that's all we've got for you this week. Thank you so much for tuning into the Green Majority, and we'll see you next time.